I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Oh, we're going to have such an interesting hour. Perhaps some of you saw it was a year-long series on C-SPAN, and it looked at the first ladies, all 45 first ladies. The programs were 90 minutes. Obviously, some of them were not as influential as others, so some were covered not in a whole 90-minute period of time, but all of those interviews now, the historians and the biographers, their comments have been edited some and placed in a brand new book. So if you want a history of the first ladies, this is the book. This is the hour. The book is First Ladies, Presidential Historians on the Lives of 45 Iconic American Women. We have two guests with us from C-SPAN. Susan Swain is the moderator for C-SPAN's year-long history series. The book is First Ladies. The TV show is First Ladies Influence and Image. She is the co-CEO of C-SPAN. She's been on air for C-SPAN interviewing historians and politicians for more than 30 years. She has done 9 book projects with C-SPAN, and we thank her very much. Susan, thank you so much for being with us. What an interesting book. Thanks.
Kathleen, I'm delighted to be here. Yeah. Thanks for your interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark Farkas is also here. Mark is executive producer of C-SPAN Specials. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks
Hi,
for having
Mark.
Us.
Hi, Mark. Yeah, our pleasure. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about First Ladies. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. I didn't know where to start. I didn't want to start with the woman I find the most interesting, but then I learned in your book something that I really didn't know about Eleanor Roosevelt, that she traveled without Secret Service from 33 to 62, 15 assassination attempts on her life. The KKK put the largest bounty in its history on her head. People dynamited trees outside churches where she spoke. They put dynamite around the tires of her car. I didn't know that she suffered from such harassment. My goodness.
It is interesting to find out, because it's been filtered through the lens of a couple of decades of history, and we see statues to Eleanor Roosevelt. But at the time, she was quite a controversial person. She took strong stands, and people reacted accordingly, either positively or negatively. She also had the largest FBI file at the time.
Hmm. And she had her own radio show before FDR did.
She did, and she really was the personification of the administration for most people, because she connected with the public in ways that he couldn't and wouldn't. She also had a regular weekly column, and she wrote about life in the White House. She got paid for that, as a matter of fact. She was the last First Lady to earn money outside the White House.
And interestingly, that radio show is what made her the first person to talk to the nation after Pearl Harbor, before FDR even addressed the country.
Oh, isn't that interesting? And what did she say? Actually, we're going to hear some of that in a moment, but her voice was first. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, it's really a history maker to have the fact that a first lady is letting the country know about something so terrible that's happening and really readying the country for another phase of the war.
Kathleen, we picked a quote that is emblematic of each first lady, and it leads the chapter for each first lady.
Yes.
And the one that we chose for Eleanor Roosevelt really picks up on the points you just raised. Courage is more exhilarating than fear, and in the long run, it is easier.
Mm. And one of the historians says she has a place of honor in the civil rights movement.
Indeed. And that's something she's not really so well known for. But she really went out farther than FDR could as a politician, given the times, or would again. And she, for example, really supported the Tuskegee Airmen during the war and flew with their planes. And she was very, very much out front in her relations between blacks and whites in America. That's part of the reason you saw for the death threats, frankly. But after she left the White House, she continued on her human rights causes, working with the United Nations, and took it to a global scale.
Mm-hmm. Plus, she must have had absolutely no sleep, because somebody cites how many letters she wrote, 150 letters a day. Can you imagine that all by herself?
Yeah, she's really quite a woman, really very interesting. And in her interest and passion for public policy and connecting with the public all the way till the day she died, she presents not just a model for future First Ladies, but really a model breaker in many ways. No
yes.
one quite like her.
No, nobody ever quite like her. Let's hear just a little bit of Eleanor Roosevelt because she's worth hearing. And this is addressing the nation after Pearl Harbor. Eleanor Roosevelt, perhaps the most interesting. Would you agree, First Lady, we've had?
Months now, the knowledge that something of this kind might happen has been hanging over our heads. And yet, it seemed impossible to believe, impossible to drop the everyday things of life and feel that there was only one thing which was important, preparation to meet an enemy, no matter where he struck. That is all over now, and there is no more uncertainty. We know what we have to face, and we know that we are ready to face it.
Eleanor Roosevelt, let's go back to the first lady. We've always talked about George Washington, how he set the presidency, set a model, two terms, wasn't a monarch. And I guess you could say in some ways Martha sort of set the legacy too in terms of her caring, her taking care of the soldiers in the middle of the winter. How did she set, to be the first lady was not an easy thing, Susan. So what did she do?
She was very aware, as was the president, that everything that they did would set precedent for those who followed. And so very important decisions that don't seem so important now, such as what would they be called, became very important symbols to the public and to the rest of the people serving in government. People were drawing upon allusions from the monarchy because that's the world that they knew. But the Washingtons really wanted to elevate the democracy, the democratic process. And so they eschewed the more formal titles and really she wanted to be called Lady Washington.
Hmm. And I also think one of the interesting things about her, again, going back to these quotes that are at the beginnings of the chapters, she really sets the tone for a theme that plays out through all these first families and first ladies. She says, "I never go to the public place. Indeed, I think I am more like a state prisoner than anything else. There are certain bounds set for me which I must not depart from, and as I cannot do as I like, I am obstinate and stay at home a great deal." So it really hits upon that private life and public life that these first ladies have to balance. And even if you take a look at Michelle Obama today, she's undergoing the same type of tugs and pulls.
Yeah. Right. Politics is the family business. And for many of these women, they were drawn into it because they loved the person they married, the man they married. Others were complete politicians themselves and fully involved in the family business. But in any case, because they are not the ones holding office, and they have to take care of the family, they always have this public-private tug that they have to deal with. And that's really one of the themes that runs throughout this book and how the women deal with this duality.
Yeah. You write about, or one of the historians writes about Martha, it's important to know, and I don't think many of us know a whole lot about her, how smart and how powerful she was and how dependent he, George, was on her. How so?
Well, she ran Mount Vernon for long stretches of time while he was away working on the public's business, and she ran it quite admirably. She was quite the business person.
The richest woman in the colonies, probably, after her first husband had died. And so I think George did quite well for himself. It was interesting. One of the things that we found in the series is that we all have this image of Martha Washington as this grandmotherly type, because that's of most of the images of her. But one of the authors, Patricia Brady, had done a book where they got anthropologists to take a look and do a simulation of what Martha Washington would have looked like when George met her. And she was quite a fetch.
Right. He was a hunk. He was a hunk, but she was quite a catch,
yes.
too.
Oh, it's funny to think of Martha that way, is it? Martha is quite a catch. The other one who was quite a catch, and one of the historians says, looked every inch a queen, was good old Dolly Madison.
Oh, Dolly's among my favorites.
She
for
is,
one thing,
yeah.
she's around for such a long time. She was the wife of the Secretary of State before she came into office as First Lady, and for many, many decades afterwards, she was quite the doyen in Washington, and future administrations, when they were in office, would invite her back because she was a connection to the Revolutionary era, and people loved her company. What's really fun to think about them, I want your listeners to just conjure up this image of this very short, slight man that she married in his waistcoat and his powdered wig, and Dolly Madison, who towered over him, and then, just to make the point, wore a turban with a large feather in it. So that in the White House, when people would come in, she was always be seen. And she used that as part of her parlor diplomacy, because people would gravitate to her and she would make the connections that were important to his presidency.
She became closely associated in the book as a symbol of American womanhood. Her name and her image get co-opted by everything to do with ice cream. Explain that to me. Hairpins and even a sexy Dolly brand of cigars.
Well, she became one of the early marketing tools for American business people because she was so popular. In fact, Mark should tell the story about the White House and the Brits wanting to find her as opposed to the president when they were coming. But I think the ice cream story is one that ice cream was just becoming to be popular. I heard that her favorite flavor was actually oyster ice cream.
Ooh. Oh boy.
They really didn't eat the same kind of ice cream that we eat today. But when ice cream began to be more and more popular, her name was attached to it. I think I was even buying Dolly Madison ice cream when I was a kid. So it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, it sounds familiar to me, too.
Might be an East Coast thing, though.
Yeah. You're going to talk about the Brits?
Well, it's a fascinating tale of Dolly Madison at the White House. James Madison and James Monroe were set up to have dinner, but they left the White House. And it was really the Brits now coming down, burning the Capitol, on their way to the White House, knowing that Dolly Madison was there. And it's an incredibly, I think, tragic story, for one, that the Madisons have to run from the White House. But she famously helps, along with their slave, Paul Jennings, save the portrait of George Washington. But in the immediate aftermath of the war, of the burning of the White House, the Madisons are seen as cowards. And I think it's Dolly who helps sort of bring them back, as so many of these first ladies do. They're a softer, sometimes more popular part of the duo, and Dolly really helps with with their image on the way back.
Mm-hmm. I was also thinking of the story when the Admiral made it into the White House. She had the table set for dinner as though she was going to have a dinner party that evening, and he picked up her cushion and took it as a souvenir because he wanted something that had been where Mrs. Madison's bum had been.
Oh, that's a great story. And she died in poverty, really, didn't she?
She had a son, Payne Todd, and that's another recurring theme, I think, through so many of these first ladies and first families, especially in the 19th century, of tragedy and alcoholism. And, and Payne Todd was the son that really bled her dry in terms of the finances. And she went back to Montpelier with James and nursed him through the rest of his life. And then came back to Washington, but yes, really relied on the largesse of some of her friends in D.C. Mm-hmm.
To make this contemporary for your listeners, there's a debate going on in our country right now about how much ex-presidents spend after they leave office. And in fact, there's some legislation on Capitol Hill right now about whether or not those funds should be restricted when presidents make over a certain amount. But we did not have a pension program for first families until Harry Truman.
Oh.
And so there's quite a few stories of presidents who were impoverished. Your listeners will remember the famous ones of General Grant, who was dying of cancer and struggled to finish his memoir so that his family would have something to live on. So for quite a long time, we didn't really think about the lives of these people after they gave so much to our country.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember her name, but was it First Lady Grant? Who was the one who really didn't want to leave the White House, who wanted her husband to be in three terms, and cried and just sobbed?
Julia Grant.
It was Grant. Yeah.
It was Julia Grant. She threw lavish parties. It was, you think about it, after so many years of Ulysses Grant being in the field as an officer in the Civil War, and before that, his military career and the failures that he has as a businessman, and she's following him all this time. It is everything that she wanted, and she begged him to run for a third term, and apparently the story is cried and cried and cried.
And he still said no.
Yes.
He was ready.
Yeah, I can imagine. We're welcoming phone calls, so feel free to join our conversation. First Ladies, Presidential Historians on the Lives of 45 Iconic American Women. It was the C-SPAN series from President's Day 2013 through the same day, 2014. And so this is the book that is a result of that TV series. Susan Swain was the moderator of the special year-long series, First Ladies Influence and Image. She is a co-CEO of C-SPAN, and she has been a host for 30 years on C-SPAN, interviewing all kinds of people, and has done many books with C-SPAN and public affairs. And Mark Farkas is also joining us. He is executive producer of C-SPAN specials. Is there a first lady who you find absolutely captivating? Who was the most important first lady of all time, the most influential, the most controversial? We'll talk about some others who have left us more of a record, like Abigail Adams, who taught us so much about what families went through during the Revolutionary War because she kept so many letters. There are other stories that are humorous, how first ladies have seen their role, beautification projects done by Lady Bird Johnson, and the cherry tree story, and the raccoon in the bathtub in the White House, and the list goes on. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Would you agree with my assessment that probably the most important was Eleanor Roosevelt? Harry Truman said about her, she was the first lady, not only of this country, but of the world. We'll be with you and continue with our guests in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Before we jump to phones, though, let's please, Susan, I know it's one of your favorite stories, and after I learned about it, it's one of my favorite stories. Tell us the story of Rebecca the Raccoon.
Well, the first lady attached to Rebecca the Raccoon is a first lady who had a very famously silent husband, Grace Coolidge. They had an incredible tragedy. They had two teenage sons that they sent away to private school. The sons came back to the White House on a break, and one of them, while playing an innocuous thing, a game of tennis on the White House courts, got a blister that turned into sepsis and died a very painful death in front of his parents. They couldn't save him. But they were also tried to continue their lives. They were famously pet lovers and animal lovers. Someone sent them a raccoon, I think intending it to be a nice dinner for the Coolidges. They were appalled and gave her amnesty and made her a pet inside the White House.
Of course.
Raccoons, however, don't have the best manners, and fairly soon Rebecca was climbing the drapes and batting people around with soap bars in the bathroom, and the White House staff were mutinying, and they had to finally send Rebecca out to the country for the rest of her life.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know people ate a lot of raccoons. That's kind of scary. Every now and then we'll encounter a raccoon in the garbage can or around that, and they kind of scare you. It's amazing they took it in as a pet, isn't it?
It's a good thing our country's made a couple of advances since then.
Absolutely.
You know, I'll tell you something. One of the people that we did an early interview with on the radio, his mother had a pet raccoon named Rebecca, and now he knows how the connection was made.
Great. Let's go.
Can I just say one thing for your callers? Yeah. It's a big week for First Ladies News, and they may also want to talk a little bit about this because we have a former First Lady who's going to make it official on Saturday. And there's a big story percolating around our world in politics this week because Lindsey Graham, who has announced, who is not married, and it's been quite a long time. Grover Cleveland was the last unmarried president when he ran for office. He has said he will have rotating first ladies stepping into the role for him. So we looked back in history and found out he won't be the first to do that either. But it's an interesting concept to be thinking about the ongoing presidential campaign and this spouse, which would be a first first gentleman if the Clintons are successful. And maybe if Lindsey Graham gets elected, we wouldn't have a first lady. So roles, once again, might change.
Well, you need kind of a hostess or host in some way, don't you, to be there to greet everybody?
Absolutely. Mark can talk more about this, but it started with Dolly Madison and parlor diplomacy, because a lot of politics is done in social settings.
Right.
Oh, you absolutely need it. I mean, there's no, the White House is a stage for the president, and the first lady plays such a key role, I think, in successfully making it a stage for them in terms of their entertainment. I mean, there's so much that goes into pulling off a state visit, all the behind the scenes activities.
Yep.
Those are all coordinated by the first lady and the State Department as well.
Mm-hmm. Who was it, Buchanan, who never married? The only president who never married, right?
That's correct, but he had a niece who was wildly successful as a first lady. She was enormously popular during her day, and in fact was only one of two first ladies who had a Coast Guard ship named after. Her name was Harriet Lane.
Ah. Let's go to some phone calls, starting with Cindy in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is that you were talking about Dolly, as Dolly Madison is giving us ice cream or associating with ice cream. But if I remember correctly, it was Abigail Adams who led to the acceptance of the smallpox vaccine. Is that not correct? I think she gave the vaccine to her children when it was really new and unknown.
Boy, that's a story that we don't know, because it didn't happen during the White House years, which is what we focused on. But it wouldn't surprise me about her, because she was very forward-thinking. She also held that family together during very, very challenging times when there was a war around their farm in Massachusetts. So I wouldn't be surprised that she was that kind of an experimental person in helping her family's health.
No, and she was. That is a true story. And Abigail Adams is a very, very interesting person. She may be one of my favorites as well. Partially, it's because she had all these letters, right? She was just a beautiful writer, and as one of the historians say on your series, they are extraordinary records, the best record we have of women's roles in the American Revolution.
I really think she is the eyes and the ears for the Continental Congress in terms of what's going on up in Boston. You know, she takes John Quincy Adams and her other children to watch the Battle of Bunker Hill, and she's writing John Adams constantly during this time period. So it is an amazing record of that time period, and it's so different than some of the other first ladies. Unfortunately, Martha Washington burns all of her letters between George and Martha. So what don't we know about them that we could have learned? So the Adams family in general are writers. Now, once she gets to the White House, she's together with him a little bit more than she was before, so there's not as many letters. That doesn't mean that she stops writing. She's writing to newspapers. She's staying very active in what she called the White House was a splendid misery.
Mm. Yes, and she was a bit intrusive, we learned, about in the president's work. In fact, she was derogatorily referred to as Madam Presidentress.
Yes.
Because she put her nose in places where they didn't always want her to in this town.
Mm. The first family to live in the White House, but it was not ready for people to live there, right?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the East Room was used as a place to dry clothes. It was a very damp White House. The outside was it was basically a construction site when they got there. And it sort of is indicative of their time in the White House. It was brief, because he's only there for a little while, and he loses the next election to his arch rival, who Abigail could not stand for a while. I think they made up toward the end, but lost to Thomas Jefferson. And in that time, they also lost a son, Charles, to alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the White House, let's go back to Dolly for just a moment and to the people who came next. How long was the White House, how long did it take to rebuild it after the Brits burned it in the War of 1812?
Well, the Monroes were able to move back in the latter half of their presidency, but it also had to be furnished because all of that was gone. It was really badly hit by the Brits. And one of the interesting things about the Monroes is that they had chosen French influence for the furnishings of the White House. And that was as controversial back then as it would be today if we knew that presidents were ordering a lot of furniture from France. People thought, buy American. What are you doing here? But they had such a continental style. They had lived in France and Europe, and they really thought that it made America more like the capitals of Europe, which is what they were trying to do, is put this city on a national stage.
But Congress actually passed a law during the Monroe administration that the White House could only be furnished by American items. They had gone so overboard. But today, when you go into the White House, into the Blue Room, which you see so often as a backdrop for a presidential statement, that is the room really that reflects the Monroe period, and that French furniture is still there today.
Interesting. Were they the ones who were friends of Napoleon's?
Friends of the Lafayettes. It's interesting that Elizabeth Monroe, when you think of reluctant first ladies versus first ladies who relished the role, she was really rather reluctant to step into it. But that doesn't mean she's not an interesting person. During his time as the minister to France, it's a time of the Reign of Terror. Robespierre has just been executed. And she and he famously, Madame Lafayette is about to get the same treatment, and they famously take a carriage ride down to the prison, and she is let go. So she is part of saving the life of Madame Lafayette.
Mm-hmm. There is, and I can't we'll talk about the various first ladies who really were, we think of Jackie Kennedy, but there were others who were really fashion plates, who really spend a whole lot of money getting very fine clothes frequently from Paris.
Well, I was going to mention, as a fashion plate, her predecessor, Mamie Eisenhower, who was setting all the rage during the late 50s when she was in office. It will make people laugh to think about this, but she was famous for those very short bangs that she wore.
Right.
And women wanted to emulate them so much that they sold clip-on bangs that you could wear to look more like Mamie.
Really? I didn't know that.
There was also a color of pink, because Mamie did everything in pink.
Yes.
If you visit the Eisenhower farm now in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, you can see pink rooms everywhere. But they named a color after her called Mamie Pink that you could buy and paint your own rooms that color.
We visited that farm on a trip we took with listeners a couple of years ago, and I was struck by how modest the farm was, but they had all the closets open, and indeed there were a lot of pink dresses in there, huh?
She was quite the fashion plate.
It's hard to imagine General Eisenhower going to bed in that pink bedroom.
Right.
He was secure in his manhood.
Yes.
I guess so. And she was the first lady to desegregate the Easter egg, White House Easter egg roll. Hunt.
That's right.
Whatever it is, right?
That's right. Yes, indeed she was.
And the other thing that's interesting about Mamie Eisenhower, I think, is that if you take a look, the series and the book really tracks what's going on in the country. And during the Eisenhower administration is the first time that women outnumber men in the electorate. And the Eisenhower, the campaign advisors begin to use Mamie just as much as they do Ike in the campaign. So it's a transitional time in American politics.
We certainly welcome phone calls. We ask the question, who do you think was the most influential first lady? Do you have a favorite first lady, somebody that you followed very, very carefully? The book that we're talking about this hour was a C-SPAN series for a year, and the book that has followed is First Ladies, Presidential Historians on the Lives of 45 Iconic American Women. We're welcoming phone calls for both of our guests, Susan Swain, who is C-SPAN's co-CEO, moderator of this particular series and on air with all kinds of interviews. And Mark Farkas is executive producer of the C-SPAN specials. So let us know. You're very quiet this hour. I thought you'd talk about who your favorite first lady was. I started, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt. I think she was the most interesting. Is there somebody from way back, or if you look at current first ladies, what do we expect of them? Who you think has stepped outside the role, who's added to the role, who's been influential, who's been important? We welcome your phone calls. And, you know, we can talk about this. I just thought we'd want to talk about more history. But if you would like to discuss what would happen, maybe you will, if Hillary Clinton were elected president, who would be the first husband? Is that who it would be? Can you imagine Bill Clinton in that role? Lindsey Graham, who says that he would have rotating first ladies. What do you think of that? Oh, we have to talk about Mary Todd Lincoln. We'll talk about her next. But answer the question. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. We find her, Mary Todd Lincoln, endlessly fascinating and rather controversial. Why are so many books still written about her?
Well, they're mostly written about her husband, and she hasn't gotten as much coverage through history. That's why we were glad to do that. She was enormously controversial in her day because she spent a lot of money while the war was going on. Mark, can you tell more about that?
Well, Lincoln famously said she's basically spending all this money on flub dubs for this damned old house, while our soldiers, you know, don't have boots and shoes. But I think, you know, she's also a misunderstood character from American history. I think that she was a real political partner when they were in Springfield. She really was integral in his campaign. She's also indicative, again, of this tragedy that these first ladies go through.
Yeah.
I try to think, I'm a father of two daughters. I try to think what life would be like for my wife and I if we'd lost one of them. They lose three sons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and one of them during the White House years. So how would that affect you? Again, it goes back to this personal story behind so many of these women.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, she was very depressed about the loss of her son. But Abraham Lincoln himself had bouts of melancholia, and she was the one who had the special touch to help bring him out of that. So they were very important psychologically to one another. It was a really interesting partnership. He was quite depressed after his unsuccessful bid for the Senate and may have given up politics. Who knew? I mean, he had been a successful railroad lawyer before that, and it was she who said that he had what it took to continue on in politics and really encouraged him to go forward. And so she played a very important role in history. What would our country's history be like if we had not had Abraham Lincoln?
Well, I know.
I think to top it off in terms of, you know, the difficulties for her as a first lady, keep in mind she was from the South. She had relatives fighting for the South. She was criticized in the press for that. There were rumors that she indeed was a spy herself. So I think, you know, all these different things that were going on really conspired for a very unhappy time in the White House for
right.
her.
But she disassociated herself from her relatives,
she did.
And she said, if they fought for the Confederacy, they not only fought against my husband, but my country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Was she criticized, do you know, during the time, because you mentioned the tragedy. Obviously, there was a lot of tragedy in the country at that time with people losing their sons in the horrible Civil War. She lost her sons, but she lost the first one that she lost in the White House. She pretty much couldn't stand to have the Marine Band play. She was locked herself away. The president was concerned about her. Were people saying to her, listen, we've been through this too. Get over it. You've got a role to fill here. Was she criticized for her grief?
I'm not sure that I saw so much her being criticized for her grief, although her husband, it's interesting the way that he dealt with it versus the way that she dealt with it.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of melded the grief that the country was undergoing with the loss of half a million lives. And she actually, in one of the documentaries that we did on the White House, he had a conversation with her saying, you've got to get a hold of yourself or you're going to end up over there. And over there was pointing at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. So she never went into the room where Willie died again. She never looked at the bed that Willie had died in. So I think it was, obviously very difficult, and they dealt with it in two distinct ways.
It's also worth noting that she had a very serious accident that resulted in a very serious head injury. And at the time, the president couldn't pay any attention to her. It happened on the 2nd of July, 1863, the second day of the Battle of Gettysburg. His attention was focused elsewhere. So it was not an easy life for her as well.
Right.
The other thing that's really fascinating to me is this relationship she has with her dressmaker, Elizabeth Keckley, a former slave who is very involved in contraband camps in Washington, D.C., and Mrs. Lincoln gets involved in those as well. She's visiting those. She's
gave money.
Yeah, she gave money. She is visiting Civil War veterans in the hospital. So she's also, you know, keeping herself busy with the business of the nation.
But our historian said about her that she had no sense of PR.
Right.
So unlike other first ladies who might have tipped off a reporter that she was going to the hospital to visit the soldiers, she never did that. So she really didn't get public credit for those acts of kindness that she did do.
Mm-hmm. Facebook comment from John. My favorite is Jackie Kennedy. She may not have been the best, but she was First Lady when I was young and made the presidency look regal in the best sense, giving the country something to look up to. Michelle Obama has been great too, and Rosalind Carter.
Well, Jacqueline Kennedy was a game changer because she was part of a new generation and she herself was so young. And then that incredible tragedy that played out in front of your listeners' eyes, she became the person who exuded calm in the face of tragedy and gave us this sense that the pageantry that she was able to put together in just a couple of days would carry us through this period of incredible tragedy and that we could go on. She went, actually, here's the connection between First Ladies, and it happens so often. She went back immediately to the Lincoln funeral and pulled the records from that and used that as some of the basis for the funeral that they would pull together in such a short time for President Kennedy.
And I think another part of her legacy is the White House today. Because before Jackie Kennedy, there had been other first ladies who were very interested in the history of the White House. She's really the one who acted upon it and brought back that history. So that home that you see today and the White House Historical Association, who were our partners in the series, I don't think it would be the same unless Jackie Kennedy had had that effort.
It's true. She not only saw that the White House should be a museum rather than just the president's house. Prior to that, presidents got a stipend and they could furnish it the way they wanted. And the presidents in the 1940s and 50s brought in decorators of the time, and it was very fashionable for the 1940s and 50s. But when the Kennedys arrived, she thought it looked much like an old New York hotel, and it probably did. And she had this sense that it needed to be a permanent place of as a museum, and started the White House Historical Association, and also enacted regulations that presidents couldn't change the furniture without approval from this committee at the Historical Association, so that over time it would continue to build its collection, but also be a preservation of American history.
We're talking about the First Ladies this hour of our program, First Ladies, Presidential Historians on the Lives of 45 Iconic American Women. It is the book that goes with the C-SPAN series, which aired from 2013 to 2014, and it looks at each in great detail from historians and biographers, each of our country's 45 First Ladies. We're welcoming phone calls and getting other kinds of messages from you. Our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our guests are Susan Swain, who is C-SPAN's co-CEO, and she was the moderator of this series on First Ladies and has interviewed for C-SPAN many, many people. Mark Farkas is executive producer of C-SPAN's Specials. We'll be back with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll talk about our current First Lady in a moment, but first let's hear her talk about the role of the First Lady.
But I think it's all an evolutionary process. You grow into this role, and my sense is that you never get comfortable if you're always pushing for change and growth, not just in yourself, but in the issues that you care about. You're never done, so there's never a point in time where you feel like, there, I am now here, and I can do this the same way all the time. It's always changing. It changes given the state of the issues of the country, and you never know what those are going to be from one day to the next. So you have to be flexible and fluid and open to evolve.
Teresa sends an email saying, my favorite First Lady is Michelle Obama, intelligent, charming, dedicated, and able to rise above unprecedented vilification and insult.
I wonder what your listeners might think about what is ahead for Michelle Obama. She'll be young when she leaves the White House, and there are now several models of former First Lady available to her. Be interesting to see whether or not she chooses a career in public life, whether she devotes herself to the Obama Library and Foundation and causes, or does something else. I wonder what people would like to see of her.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Anton in Eau Claire. Hi, Anton.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Yeah, especially in modern times, there is a lot of talk about many first ladies being very unhappy in their marriage. The gossip news always talks about impending divorce. I was just curious, and that they stayed more or less because of their stand-by-their-man attitude. I was curious if there ever was a divorce after their husbands left office in all that history. And I hang up and listen to the radio.
Okay, thanks, Anton.
Not so far. I think a lot of the first couples really are a window into American marriages and life in general. And I think a lot of them struggled with their relationships before, during, and probably after the presidency, but none yet have been divorced.
The second family had a divorce in it. The Gores split
right
up after their term in the White House and his unsuccessful bid for the presidency. But Mark's right, none among the presidents themselves, no matter how many challenges they might have faced. Politics is a tough job. And I'll tell people a story that illustrates how focused many of these people are on their political careers. Betty Ford's husband, Gerald, left her waiting a bit at the altar because he was out campaigning the morning of their wedding and arrived at the church with muddy shoes as a result. And then for their honeymoon, he took her to a campaign rally, something that he said he paid dearly for the rest of their
I'll
marriage.
I'll bet he did. And there was, I don't know how many fit this classification, but you write about Rachel Donaldson Jackson, who was divorced when she met, was not divorced when she met Andrew Jackson, right? She was vilified for being a divorced woman.
There was some controversy whether the divorce was actually consummated by the time she married Andrew Jackson, and it became a huge campaign issue. But, you know, then she was one of those first ladies who did not want to make it to the White, didn't want to go to the White House. She died between the election and the inauguration day. And it had an effect on Andrew Jackson. He blamed basically his opponents for that, and it sort of clouded his time as president.
Hmm. Victor is next in West Allis. Hi, Victor.
Hi. Always enjoying your program.
Thanks.
My question is, Mr. Carter, which I really love as a president, you don't hear much about his wife. She was really low-key, you know, compared to, like, Mrs. Obama and other people. So what was her personal passion while she was a first lady?
Well, she really wasn't low-key at all during the White House years. Mark can tell the story of the controversy that she got into because she really wanted to be very involved in public policy.
She attended cabinet meetings, which I think sort of turned some of Carter's advisors, rubbed them the wrong way. She came up, you know, her main issue was mental health, and wanted to chair a mental health presidential commission, and really was planning on doing that, and then was told that she could not, as a family member, do that. And so she talked to us in an interview about just how upset she was about two things. One, that the mental health initiative really never got the attention of the press. She met someone in the hallway of the White House and said, "Why don't you cover my press conferences and my initiative?" And they said, "It's just not sexy enough." And then she was very upset that Reagan basically was about to, she thought it was about to pass Congress, and he tabled it. So she was very, very active as a first lady, traveled a lot as well.
Was an official representative of the United States to South America to a big conference. So the president, they were a political couple from the get-go. When he was running for office, they split up, which was unusual, and campaigned separately. She used to drive herself around the South, look for the radio transmitter towers, figure there was a station underneath of them, drive to it, and book herself for interviews. So she was very much his partner from the very beginning.
And she got married when she was 18.
Yes, I love the wedding picture of the two of them.
So
really,
young.
Age 18.
Woo. So young. Some caller, Chris, wants to mention Lady Bird Johnson, who single-handedly saved wildflowers and other parts of the environment with her advocacy. And we have Lady Bird, a little bit of a clip of Lady Bird, who is giving her husband, LBJ, a critique of one of his TV speeches. Talk about partners in the White House. There were a lot of them. Here's Lady Bird Johnson.
Listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till
tonight? Yes, ma'am. I'm willing now.
I thought that you looked strong, firm, and like a reliable guy. Your looks were splendid. The close-ups were much better than the distance ones.
Well, you can't get them good.
Well, I would say this. There were more close-ups than there were distance ones. During the statement, you were a little breathless, and there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. Not enough change of pace. Dropping voice at the end of sentence. There was a considerable pickup in drama and interest when the questioning began. Your voice was noticeably better, and your facial expression was noticeably better.
She could have been a. Isn't that great? It's a great clip. She could have been a political consultant.
No one in Washington could talk to LBJ that way, except for Lady Bird.
Yeah.
And how important it was for him to have that kind of counseling. They were a very, very interesting couple. And she, a very successful first lady, she's another diarist. She kept a diary of every day during her time as wife of the vice president through the White House and beyond, including the day of the Kennedy assassination, where she wrote about seeing the first lady in her bloody suit that many of us have seen over news clips or saw it in the time, and how that broke her heart when she saw the president's blood all over the back of the limousine and realized the tragedy that had just unfolded in front of them.
Mm-hmm. And she is a first lady that other first ladies from both parties mention a lot when they're interviewed about looking back as role models. Laura Bush, in the interview we did with her, talks about Lady Bird. Now, they're both from Texas, so there's a connection there. But she really is, and I think people tend to think of the wildflowers and the beautification as something that just made the nation prettier, but it's really on the forefront, as our historians in the show talked about, of the environmental movement.
Great conservation program. It was really important. And it complemented Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program, because it wasn't just wildflowers on highways. She also wanted and got money for gardens planted in cities, inner cities, as a complement to the social programs that he had as part of his presidency. She felt that if people's environment was more inviting, they would be able to live happier lives, and we've all seen that in our own lives as well.
Mm-hmm. Tony in Mount Horeb. Hi, Tony.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank Ms. Swain and Mr. Farkas for their other series on the presidents and the White House, Capitol, and Supreme Court as well. It's tremendous, especially.
Thank you. And
thank
Mark
you.
Farkas, my colleague, was the producer of all of those. He does great work.
Yeah. Wonderful. My question was about Teddy Roosevelt and Alice Lee. If you could tell that story a bit, and then how he lost a parent and his wife on the same day, and then went on to Edith Carroll and the great love that they had.
That really is a heartbreaking day in the life of Theodore Roosevelt. He was in Albany. He was in the state legislature and got word that his wife, who was having a child, was having a problem and he should return home. He came home to find her really having quite difficulty with the birth. And not only that, as the caller said, in the same household in New York City, his mother was expiring just a couple floors apart. He lost both of them, and it was Valentine's Day.
When you go to the Library of Congress, where the presidential paper section is, in TR's diary on that day is just an X with the words, "The light has gone out of my life."
Now, the caller is right. It turned around quite nicely for him. It would have been proper for a man of that time to be an unhappy widower for a while. But in fact, he reconnected with a childhood friend. They married, had many children together, and a very happy marriage.
Thanks so much, folks.
Thank you very much for your call. So you did another series together on the presidents?
We did, and we also did a very fun series called The Contenders on people that ran for president and lost but changed the country's history.
Oh. When was the presidential series on? I haven't seen that.
That was 1999 and ended right into 2000.
Oh. Mark and I have been at this for quite a while.
I guess you have.
It's fun.
I would it's great fun.
Each series is like going back to school. You get a graduate degree in a different topic.
Absolutely. That's why I do talk shows for a living. It's like going...
And may we tell you about our new one coming up next fall?
Absolutely. Quickly. We're almost out of time.
We're going to be looking at 12 Supreme Court cases in history that changed the fate of the nation.
Oh, interesting.
So back to school once again.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for being with us. And it's a great reference book and very interesting. Thanks for doing this.
Kathleen, we loved it. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Susan Swain, C-SPAN's co-CEO. She's the moderator of the series on the First Ladies and is an on-air huge presence on C-SPAN. Mark Farkas, executive producer of C-SPAN Specials. We thank them for being with us. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to Judith Sears-Poisson for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And while we're on a historical path here, we do want to tell you that we will be talking, we do presidential histories frequently. On Thursday, it's Andrew Jackson. Steve Inskeep will be our guest. And the book is Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. So that's coming up on Thursday during this particular hour for all of you people who love history. Which means everybody listening, right? News is coming up from National Public Radio, so stay tuned for that. And thanks for being a part of our two-hour conversation here today. I'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.